Okay, I guess basically the first thing is how long have you've been in Kodiak all your life?
Well, not in Kodiak. I was born on Woody Island. And I've been lived here and thereabouts, in the vicinity.
Okay, and your parents, were they from
Well, they were from, my mother was from Unga, Alaska. That's down in the southeast, down towards Chinook Bay, down the Alaska, what is that, not peninsula, but that Aleutian Islands.
Okay.
And my father was from Euganic Bay. He was born over there. And both of my parents were in the Kodiak Baptist Mission. They were sent to the Kodiak Baptist Mission when they were, my mother must have been about around 8 or 9 years old, I think, and she was raised in the mission, and she married Papa right out of the mission, they
Wow.
married from there.
So they met right there in the mission.
Yes, well, they were, children in the home.
Gosh. And then from there, did they go over to Woody Island? Is that when they
Well,
went
they
over
know they
there?
lived. Well, the mission was over on Woody
Yeah,
Island. It
right.
wasn't to any place. It was over on Woody Island, and they married. Of course, I don't know just what the transition was, because they were Baptist, and my mother. I was looking at the old at some of the papers from the Russian Church records, and there's a record in Russian, written in Russian longhand, of Nikolai Fedayev and Fekla married in this church,
Oh,
in
in the
this
Russian
the Holy,
Orthodox.
Holy Resurrection. And
Oh.
so you see, there must have been some sort of transition, whether they got out of the mission and got married, or whether they had some sort of agreement with the priest. And but they did get married by a priest. They didn't get married out of
The Baptist.
the Baptist Church. My mother was a Baptist. She liked being Baptist.
And they were still, did they raise you as Baptist then?
No. We were absolutely Orthodox. We were,
Really?
yeah, we were.
So
Well,
somehow there was a
most
change.
Native people are,
Yeah.
The only ones that are affected are the latter day missionary type, that for all the missionary work that supposedly went, that none of it went out to the people. It was just work on the children. They didn't go out and visit the people and say, "Hey, this is better than yours." As
Right.
they stayed there and shot at them from the sidelines.
And basically worked on the children.
Yes, on the children, but it didn't seem to work, because there's many of them that went back to their, as soon as they were out of the mission, they went back to their own church.
Okay. What about now, what was it like when you were growing up? I mean, I'm sure everything was quite different back
Well, it
then.
was different. It was different. There was, we were just talking about it then. We lived in a subsistence fashion, because over on Woody Island there was, see, this was considerably, I was born about 4 or 5 years after the eruption. And Woody Island had had a salmon stream over there, but during the eruption, this clogged the salmon stream up, killed off all the salmon, so they didn't have this constant food source. So they had to rely on going off to the streams and things like that over here, going over here, or ducks, And I remember Papa loading shells. They didn't just buy a go and buy a box of shells. You loaded shells. You made the shot and everything. We had an upstairs attic thing that Papa used to keep his things in, and I used to watch him fill the molds and things like that too. So everything was, made from scratch. You did it. We ate duck. We had seal. We had fish. Much fish, clams, not much clams over there, but we had all these other things. We dried fish, we salted fish, we smoked fish, we canned fish. When canning became into, see, while I was small, all of that stuff wasn't too popular, and not much of it crept over into our bailiwick, you know, because we were miles and miles separated from the South 48. You know, we didn't know a whole lot. We knew how to preserve food up here. We dried berries. But our favorite method was to berries like cranberries and things like that. We put them in seal oil, you know.
Seal oil?
Yes, uh-huh. We had, I remember going out in our back little Caledore, and there would be these butter kegs of berries just swimming in seal oil, you know.
And that preserved them?
Oh, yes. And then some berries that were high acid, like the high bush cranberry, and the we'd put them in water. Glasses. Oh, sweetheart. So you see, and then of course we made jelly and jam, you know, but all by the old fashioned way. When somebody, I was around 10 or 11 years old, somebody discovered Sirtol. You should have seen the ladies, they just went mad. They were making jelly all over the place. Because Sirtol has this pectin, you know.
The pectin.
You could make jelly and it always set, you know. Before that, you made jelly. If there wasn't enough pectin in your fruit, it was syrup. You didn't have any jelly.
Oh,
but everything was, but it was a nice life. You know, we planted our gardens. We had to raise enough potatoes to last us from one.
Potatoes did grow there?
Oh, yes, yes. The Russians apparently were the ones that instructed the people in how to plant potatoes, because they picked all the gardens on the island were in a real sunny location, you know, and they were close to where we had kelp beds, you know. See, because the kelp was our fertilizer.
Hmm.
We'd have these gardens, and the men would go out and they'd gather this ribbon, big heavy ribbon kelp, you know, and we'd dig up our garden, and then we'd make a big kind of a shallow spot, and we'd throw this kelp in there and cover it over, and we had wonderful gardens, really. But even then, see, we just planted potatoes and some turnips. Once in a while we planted cabbage, but most of the time we just planted potatoes and turnips, and then we did plant some cabbage for greens, you know. And lettuce, we'd plant lettuce, but I remember, I think this is before the day of mayonnaise, because we used to eat our lettuce with sugar and vinegar sprinkled over it.
Wow.
But we were fed well, you know.
What about vegetables? Were there places in town where they shipped in vegetables?
Well, you could. They did, but then they weren't too prominent either. I mean, you grew them or you went without, you know. We had lots of dried beans and peas. We could buy those in the store, and we ate. That was a staple part of our diet, you know. And we always had salt pork. We always had a barrel of salt pork. We bought that, you know. We could buy that from the store. And then we'd have the rest of our diet was duck. And we had chickens. Everybody had chickens. And most everyone had a cow, you know. When I was small, we didn't have a cow up until I was about 7 years old, but after that we always had cattle, and we butchered every year, you know, so that we had
and occasionally
milk we had our milk and things. Of course we were better off than most, you know, because my mother was ambitious and a busy person. There was nine of us, you know.
Wow, nine.
And my father wasn't too ambitious, but my stepfather, who later became my stepfather, was a very, you know, busy person and took good care of us. Had plenty to eat.
Wow. So as you grew up on Woody Island, did you stay there? Is that where you got married? Did you meet?
No. Well, see, we were friends. We, you know, Kelly and I, our families were good friends, you know. And when we would come over and visit, we'd come and see them, you know. Of course, I didn't always like Kelly, because she's a terrible kid. But we used to come back and forth, you know. And when we'd go home, sometimes they'd join us. They'd go Nalisnon, that means going over to the island, you know. And we'd visit back and forth. So we you might say that our that we were, you know, we've been friends for years and years, you know, and we always we didn't have engines in those days, you know. The only the very very rich people had engines, and there was certainly no these outboards and things like that. Just started to be popular when I was around 10 or 12. You could buy one, and they were affordable, you know, and you could and you use them. But then most people rode back and forth to town. We rode back and forth to town all the time, you know. And it's nothing. I mean, it seems to be such an insurmountable thing. I've rode back and forth to town many times, you know, and thought nothing of it. I'd dump my kids in a skiff and away we'd go, you know. And we just did that.
You know, it was the way of life, just.
Yes, yes, you know. And if we wanted to go to town, if one of us needed to go to town for something, we had to come over and have a tooth pulled or something. As one of our neighbors was an old German fellow, we called him John Miller, you know, old John Miller. He's married to a native woman named Fedora. And John Miller was one of the slowest rowers I ever saw. He never sat in a seat and pulled this way. He sat in a seat and pushed this way. So when you went to town with John Miller, you knew that you'd have a two-hour ride when you went to the side. But we come to town with him. You bundled up good. And in the middle of the winter, you know, nobody paid any attention to the weather. Didn't. The only time the weather stopped us was none of us ever went out in blows, you know, when the surf was out or things like that. But if the weather was fairly decent and even the little rain, nobody paid any attention to the rain.
It just went. So basically all the family, nobody really worked outside of the subsistence fishing.
No. The men put up wood, you know. They chopped wood they put up cords of wood for the mission, because the mission had a furnace. You know, they had more of the amenities, I suppose, if you could call it that. The men would make these cords of wood up in the, you know, you could just go up and chop it any place you wanted to, mm-hmm. you know. And so they would cut wood and they were paid off at a certain rate, you know, but that is all they ever did. And once in a while they'd cut dory knees. And they'd bring them. Dory knees are the kinds that are what, you know, it's a natural crook in the growth of a tree, you know, from the root up.
Yeah.
And they would cut these things out and they'd sell them for maybe $1.50 a pair or something like that and make money that way. And they also would trap ermine and stuff like that, you know, they'd get $1.50 or something like
so
that.
So it was basically working the land,
yeah,
though, is
yeah,
how they were.
Yeah. But it was never it just wasn't any job.
Well, what kind of homes and heat did you have?
Well, we had wood. You
wood
know,
you
wood.
Used?
We had
like a wood stove type.
Yes.
Heater.
Well, we had a big majestic stove in our kitchen, and in the living room we had a big heater. You know, another majestic big
mm-hmm.
wood cot, and we'd just kept those things. I don't ever remember being cold. You know, we had the stove was going all the time. Occasionally we'd have coal. But we didn't usually buy much coal. We always bought wood. We didn't. We chopped our own. We didn't. The men would take the big sled and go up in the woods and chop limbs, you know, and bring them down. You knew that you were going to have plenty of good warm.
Now, was the school right there at the mission? Is that
no? The mission, the school was a territorial thing. It wasn't the mission school.
Okay.
The mission didn't have a school per se. It was territorial, and then it went to, then after the mission moved off, where there weren't many children, then we had a Indian Bureau of Indian Affairs school, you know, that state-run school.
Right.
But only for a short while, and then we didn't have any anymore. So we, yeah. So by then it was getting kind of bad, see, because we had to move, Kelly and I had to move over here with our children because Dick wasn't old enough to go to school and there wasn't any schooling for him. But see, after Kelly and I married, we moved over on the island and built our home. you know, because, well, we moved off of there because the kids couldn't go to school.
Right, so you had to come back to Kodiak.
We sold our place over there, and then they promised us a few years later that if we came back, that the FAA could get in another school if we, with our children, would make just a number enough so that they could have a school. So we moved back to the island again. So our history was kind of moving off
back and forth.
Yeah. But we had 7 children, and we had to make sure that they were getting to school. You know.
Wow. Now, were you old enough, do you remember what was going on during, like, when the war came, during the wartime?
Oh, the Second World War.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was an adult with, I must have been about 24. I had 4 children. Yeah, I had 4 children during the war, and then we had, the FAA was pretty prominent then, and the CBs, no, they hadn't come in yet, but the 12th Battalion of the Army, you know, had a sawmill that they were building up places up so that they could outfit various camps around the island, you know, places, lookouts and stuff like that. I mean, they were cutting lumber and things like that for them, and so they were pretty prominent, and we made friends, of course. In fact, we had a fellow come here in town, and I was so sorry that we weren't here. Came to town about 4 years ago looking for Kelly and I. He'd been one of our really good friends.
Wow.
That used to come by.
That was in the service,
yeah,
the military,
yeah,
man?
In the service, and we wrote to them for years after. We got to be such good friends. And they knew the children, and they would have parties for the kids, you know, put on a show for them at Christmas time because they weren't home. They were,
mm-hmm.
And of course, our kids were all the luckier for that, you know, because
right.
They had a wonderful Christmas, too. Really.
Now, did Kelly go in the service then?
No, he didn't qualify. Kelly had 4 or 5 children then during the war.
So they,
you know,
let
he just
stay.
Absolutely wasn't. And then, too, he was, you know, needed here.
Did the whole way of living change when the war was there,
not
though?
At all.
Was people
not
scared or?
Well, we were afraid. You know, it was the Japanese, I think, that frightened me more. But as it happened, I was sick. I wasn't well. I was going through a terrible, bad time in my life. But and the Japanese bombings just frightened the daylights out of me, you know. We weren't on the island there. We happened to be, Kelly was working on the dock, building a dock here in Kodiak. And so we moved over here for the summer. And, you know, it was frightening then, but a war didn't change much here. The only thing is that you had to stand in line to get silk stockings, and you had to stand in line to get booze, you know, if you wanted
mm-hmm.
it. And you couldn't travel after 4 o'clock in the evening, you know. They had, it was, they had not martial law, but they had under military supervision, they had. And I remember Kelly and my stepfather came over to town to cash their checks, and they got drunk, and they were going to go back home after the, what do you call it? And as they got in the skiff, Dad slipped and fell and made a big racket, and they were shooting over their head. And they took
them
to jail, you know.
Because they were trying to leave after the...
Yeah. But you see, well, those are things that we were just absolutely not used to. Kelly and I were getting ready to go home on the FAA boat one day, and this soldier stops us on the dock and said, halt, you know, and we kept walking toward him, and he was going to shoot us, you know, because we had no conception what the word halt,
wow.
You know. We knew it meant stop, but we didn't think
what he was
going to
do
us,
if you didn't stop.
Yeah, here's a couple of skinny kids, for heaven's sake. I have to go to the bathroom. In the mission, with all the all the training that somebody from Cape Cod would have, they had workers from Cape Cod, and you know, the mission workers and everything, and she learned how to make wonderful baked beans and clam chowder and things like that. And then she was from a native family, and then she was raised in that fashion out in Unga and Sandpoint. Then she came here, and she was, up until she was 18 years old, she was raised as a mission girl, you know, had all the everything furnished her and everything. And then she married Papa and moved into the Native community again. And, you know, and then the Native community was strictly Native, you know. My mother learned how to speak Russian, and she learned how to speak Aleut, over and above the language, Aleut language. From, and she, you know, and we lived, this is the way we lived. We didn't live like you do now, you know. Mm-hmm. We had our homes, of course, and we were nice and clean, and Mama took care of us and everything, but it was a different way of living, you know. We lived off of the land, and we had our own groups that we went to our own church. Of course, we went to two churches. Mama liked being her old church, you know, and so we would go to our church at 9 o'clock in the morning, and then we'd get out around 10 o'clock, and we'd go to the Baptist church, and we'd go to Sunday school.
So you went to church quite a bit.
Oh, yes, we went to church. We did. But, and I was laying in bed thinking, I was remembering perhaps you said that you were coming down, and there was, just before this happened, I was about 3 years old, I guess. In 1918, they had the really bad flu epidemic that wiped out so many people throughout the United States and up here. And on Woody Island, it just devastated. There was, I don't know what the population was, but believe me, by the time the flu passed on, there was considerably less. And they even had to bring in people that were in jail here and take them over the island to bury people, you know, to dig graves and things.
Wow, it was really...
Well, yes, it was just devastating. Mama said, by then we had moved down to our big house, the big house that the Papa's folks had left him. And she said that the mission would bring meat and vegetables, and she would make great big pots of soup, you know, and Papa and somebody else would take them around to the huts and make sure that people ate, you know. She said that we were lucky. She said we didn't have anything wrong with us, you know, we were pretty well. But I think it was probably hunger, you know, maybe
some of the people not eating
and cold, you know, it was especially cold season. And it must have been a particularly devastating kind of flu. Anyway, they tumbled some of the people, 5 and 6, to a grave, you know, just buried them like that. Yeah. Well, Kelly's family, Kelly had another brother, older than he, that some people, Aggies on Woody Island, took, you know, that Native families give children to one another. You know, if somebody doesn't have children or can't have children, they'll say, well, when I have my next one, I'll let you have it, you know. And they treasure these children. You know, I've seen some wonderful parents that weren't really birth parents, you know. And this is what happened to Kelly's brother. He was taken by this family, you know. And he was just about 2 years old, I think. He died during the flu, too. Mm-hmm. But some of the combinations have been just wonderful. I know one family that raised some of the nicest kids, and they were so nice themselves. You know, they just took these children and just loved them, you know, took care of them.
It's kind of
them.
Their own little adoption.
Yes, yes.
Among
yes.
each other.
And they did it all the time. Some kids didn't even know who their parents were, you know. Well, Frank Peterson, who ran Canna. My son is the head of Canna now. But Frank Peterson, you know, had the Kodiak Area Native Association. First, he told me that he was about 16 or 17 years old when he discovered that this lady that he thought was his mother wasn't his mother at all. His mother was another lady.
Wow.
But see, they treat them so well.
But they never know.
But they never know. They're treated as their own loving child, you know. And I think it's wonderful. There's some nice things about it. And it wasn't, now there are some bad instances there's some bad instances. On Kelly's birth certificate, a census report, it has him listed as a servant to this Romana family. But he was certainly no servant because his foster mother, just doted on him, you know, absolutely doted on him. He said he slept in her bed until he was 14 years old, you know.
Wow.
And when she died in his arms, you know, she didn't, because there was such a closeness there, you know. But this is the way they did. They just take children, you know, that somebody didn't really want awfully bad. Whereas in some cases they took children and they abused them just dreadfully. But those were the more intelligent people, the ones that had were more sophisticated type. I don't know if I'm explaining this right.
Yeah.
But
the more educated type,
yeah. I know one girl that she was sitting and telling me some of the things these people did to her. Like making her go carry water in the middle of the winter with no shoes on and stuff like that, you know, and beat her all the time and scrubbing clothes and things. A little skinny girl, you know, and just terribly abusive. But those are fortunately not, there wasn't many of them. I don't ever remember, maybe on two occasions.
But most of the natives were very family-oriented.
Very definitely. But on Woody Island now, there. See, when that was a large community, and it was bigger than over here in Kodiak, you know. Kodiak was small compared to Woody Island. The Russian settlement was here. But the mission was over there, the radio station was over there, and the AC company, you know, they shipped ice and things like that. And so when I was growing up and during my childhood years was when the community was dwindling, you know. There was one, the Millers and Fedora and the Chowichpucks, the Guzma's family, the Tanahans, the Pavlovs. Two or three Pavlovs families, three, four, five, there must have been about, and us, there was about nine families, 10 families over on the island then. And our church, you know, we had our own church. And gradually, by the time we moved over here for the last time, there was only about three or four families.
Yeah.
And now there's only my son and one other fellow that stay over there.
Oh, really? They still stay over there now?
Yeah, well, our son he comes and goes. He's old 58, Dick is, and he's just tootling around doing his own thing, you know. So he goes over to Uganic and stays at our home there once in a while, and then he comes back and he goes over and stays on. He's raising chickens now. He's having fun with them. But he's just having a good time.
Well, now, when the war was here, so basically you didn't really see any major changes except you had military over there now.
Yeah, well, military, and we would see the PT boats and everything come through here, you know, and we had our radios, so we knew all of the war news, you know.
Was there very many bomb scares and things?
No. It was just this one, occasion. But you see, we were terribly naive. I'm certain with all of the information we get now, we probably would have been scared to death if we knew how close maybe some of those submarines and things. We picked up on the beaches canned things and stuff like that, and tarred ducks and things like that. So we know that there must have been some sort of a submarine or some kind of explosion out to sea or something, because we picked up canned hams. Some boat must have been wrecked or destroyed, you know, or burnt out beyond Woody Island. But
and tarred ducks,
yeah,
you said?
Oh, yes. You know, ducks with oil all over them, stuff like that. But we didn't know what happened to them, and I'm sure it might have been a submarine, you know.
Right. Now, you said there was one instance here where there was...
Well, that was after the war with Japan. when they bombed Dutch Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
See, they were on their way to Kodiak apparently, and they got, it was awfully foggy. It's in the middle of the summer, and so they got lost in the fog, I guess, and just dumped their bombs in Dutch Harbor, and that was the only incident of bombing in Alaska.
Right.
But even those, I mean, didn't make too much of an impression on us, you know.
So nobody still, here was really still, concerned. Everything
well,
went pretty much the
life
same.
Life went on, you know, and people didn't. We were careful of course, in the summertime, it doesn't do any good anyway because everything's bright, you know. We were careful with our blackouts, you know, because it was really, we really kept our blackout. What do you call it? But otherwise, yeah.
Blackout. You mean they had certain times?
Yeah, we had to use shades on all of our windows. We put blankets over the windows, you know, so that there would be no light or anything escaping, so they couldn't see. If there were any enemy around, you know, they couldn't see anything.
Did they just call for these blackouts periodically, or was it a certain time every day had to?
Well,
or?
from the time it began to be dusk, you know, you just didn't
every
show
day.
Any light. Yes, we were just, you know, we were used to it. Nobody paid any attention. We just did it. You know, you didn't show any light. You weren't careless with anything. We'd go out and we'd go for clams up on the beach. Of course, by then moonlight, you could see pretty well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Go down the reef and get stuff. But we were pretty careful, too. You know, the things that we used to do, like we used to... One of the things is there's something like the Mardi Gras down in New Orleans. Only here, it's based on the Bible history, where Herod was looking for Jesus, for the baby Jesus. Well, see, here they have what they call a masquerade. So, you know, they have the Masquerade Week. You know,
right.
Our Orthodox Church. And for right after Russian Christmas is over, which is on the 7th of January, by the old Gregorian calendar, or the Julian calendar, I guess, we would have masqueraders, you know, and they'd go from house to house, you know, and usually it was just a big fun thing, you know, you'd go to somebody's house and people would cut up and they'd dance and they'd try to guess who you were, and it was just a lot of fun. But they stopped all of that. Absolutely would not allow anything like that. Is that somebody coming to our house there? No, who is that?
There. Okay, then after the war, everybody just, did they clear out right away or?
No, you see, Kelly and I had been away for a year in 1937. We lived in Cordova for a year and then we moved back home in 1939, I think, or 40, 39, I guess. And as we came back, Kodiak was starting to build up, you know, from a little one-horse village, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, here was electric plants and all these things, and people were moving in. And the surveying was going on Nyman's Peninsula. They were building up the base, you know. And here, all of a sudden, there were jobs to be had. You know, before that, all the jobs were the NRA and the WPA works and things like that, you know, 50 cents an hour. Here were jobs being offered out there for a dollar an hour. The people were just simply aghast. My goodness, we never heard of such money, you know. And so everybody went to work. We moved on the island. We built our house over there. And Kelly went to work over here. He'd try to get home as often as he could, but he couldn't get home very often. Until I got sick and he had to come home. He had to just quit and come home and take care of me. But from then, you know, then is when the transition started. Kodiak started to change, you know. Here we had electricity here. Of course, we didn't have electricity on the island. We used kerosene lamps and our pressure lamps, you know. But just things were different, you know. They had got in more cars for what, you know, they had just one delivery wagon that just ran over the dirt trails here, you know, for the craft store delivery truck. And Erskine's store had Stepan Anderson, who did the deliveries with a wheelbarrow. He'd deliver sacks of potatoes and sacks of coal.
With a wheelbarrow?
Yeah, with a wheelbarrow. Well, town was around just, you know, it was
short
just,
area.
Yeah, there was houses out as far as where Peggy and, what's his name, Dyson lived. There were maybe one or two houses there. And one old fellow lived out by Potato Patch Lake. There weren't any houses. But this was an area where the kids had a swimming pool here, you know. It was blueberry picking grounds. It wasn't anything here. These houses were put in 1950. Alaska State Housing put these in. And so there was only houses that extended as far by Hubley's, you know, and along there, and just
kind of Hubley's.
Hubley's is right on level with Sweeney's.
Okay, so just as far as Sweeney's,
yeah.
Sweeney's.
And so there was, and this was just cow paths, you know, just paths. They called over the bridge, Brooklyn. They called it Brooklyn, going down to Brooklyn side. I don't know where that came from, but I noticed that I read a manuscript. They asked me to go over it and see if I could see any corrections that he needed. A fellow that was writing down the memoirs of his aunt or uncle or something from Woody Island, and they used that Brooklyn, the bridge at Brooklyn. But...
So then everything started building.
Building
and
up and
50,
changing.
They started getting
it
houses.
It started to escalate and more businesses came in. We did have a bakery here in town. Two bakeries, I think, we had. The Star Bakery. Did we have a Star Bakery? We had Naughton's Bakery. And then we had the other one, Lalonde's Bakery. Yeah. And we always had lots of bars. Lots of bars. And... And
now,
the two stores, of course.
Crafts and
Donnelly and Anderson. They used to be Erskine's store before that. And that's the property, the governor's mansion was their property, the W.J. Erskine property. And Erskine sold it to Donnelly and Anderson around the early 40s, I think. And...
Going down.
No, nothing's too tired.
There is one, isn't
there? Wait a minute, let's see. Anyway, we didn't stay over here then. We stayed over on Woody Island, and we moved over from Woody Island in 1942, I think. And by then, they had started housing. What you call it? They were building this. No, not this place. They built this later on. They were building Sears houses out there, and you know, nobody ever had the houses like that. There was a line up down here, and then that's another thing that prosperity brought to Kodiak was the houses of ill repute. Because I never saw anything wrong with them. If people want to go there, it's their own business, you know. I don't think it did anything. But God, I knew some of the people and I liked them, you know. Just because they don't do what I do doesn't mean that they're bad. But then they moved them off of there because some do-gooder decided that they were bad for the town of Kodiak. So they moved them all out of town and moved them. And so they moved off in the sticks. But when Kelly and I moved over from Woody Island, we moved right in the midst of them. We didn't know who they were, you know. And they were nice folk. They didn't bother us. And we didn't bother them, you know. I used to pick up a few dollars altering clothes and stuff like that. And they were nice to my children. And no way did they make themselves Well, frankly, I just didn't know.
You wouldn't know that they did.
No. And so you see, a lot of it's in the in what a person makes of it, you know. Anyway, that's one thing that finally did. Well, Dr. Bob was telling me the other day, he said he used to be a delivery boy, and he said he used to have to deliver groceries down to the greenhouse and the dollhouse and those places. And he said he was scared to death. The delivery boys used to scare him all the time. Scared to death to take things down there. And I said, good heavens.
Gosh. So did things pretty much stay about the same then until, like, were there any other major changes that you can think of until maybe the time of the earthquake?
The earthquake, I think.
That was the next big change?
Well, no, crab, king crab.
Okay.
By then we had moved over to the island again, and Kelly quit his job over there in the Eisenhower administration. They froze all leaves, and he is a fisherman. He always went fishing in the summertime. Well, they froze his leaf, and he quit. So we lived apart for a while. I lived over there, and he lived over in town here, and it just didn't work, you know. It was impossible, so I moved to town here. And they were starting to really get a work on the king crab then. You know, there's lots of king crab here, and everybody and his uncle wanted, and men were making money hand over fist.
And when was this?
This was in 1956, about, you know.
Was there a lot of people from outside coming
well,
in?
Well, a lot of people from the various, from outside. There's a lot of people from the various, like Saldovia. A lot of people. Kelly's family, most of his family lived in Saldovia. His brother Sonny and all of them, they moved over here. And his mother moved over here. And just whole groups of people. Oscar Dyson moved over here. You know, he's married to one of Kelly's sisters at the time. And then there was a real time of plenty, you know. We worked in the canneries. This is before the Filipinos were, before the exodus of the Filipinos. And so the cannery was staffed by mostly people like us. I was a poor girl down there for years, and I made good money, you know. And our whole family, we lived off of it. You know, Kelly worked at the fishing on the boats. He was on the haul boats, and Dick and Buster. We all worked in the cannery together, you know, and we did. It wasn't the best wages in the world, but it was sure better than a whole lot, you know,
right.
And it was work. But now, I mean, with the Filipinos moved, you know, since they've moved in, they've just taken up all those extra little slots, you know. Sometimes I don't know about us allowing so many people into the country. I mean, charity begins at home. When do you start thinking about your own?
Mm-hmm.
Now we have the Haitians. Did you see that exodus of the Haitians?
Yeah.
Moving over by the boat, you know?
So it took a lot of jobs away from the people here.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And it ruined things in a way, because the people found out that if they didn't have a job, they could get something for it. They could go to the Family and Children's Services and say, hey, you know, I have a family, I need money, and pretty soon here's somebody else taking care of them. I mean, this is dreadful. When I was growing up, when I didn't know there was such a thing as welfare. My family, we had 9 children. We never lived on welfare. Kelly and I had 7 children. We paid for every one of them. We don't owe a soul a dime. It costs $500 to have a baby, and I have, well, 500.
That was a lot back then.
Well, yes, it was, but we paid for it, and it didn't hurt us. And I don't ever remember having to go to somebody and say, hey, we're broke. You know, we need money. Yeah, because we always did for ourselves. Those times that Kelly has been out fishing and came home with as little as a $45 check, and I was trying to rack my brain, trying to think of how he did it, you know, and I can't even remember, because it wasn't that. You're all of your, the, you know, your it proves your mettle, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's a challenge, we're survivors. You immediately start doing things to make everything all right, and it was all right.
Mm-hmm. Did so king crab really brought in a lot. That
oh
was
yes.
Year was that, you think?
In 1952, it started in about 1948 gradually on, you know. But from the 1950s, boy, they were, I worked in a plant where we had sometimes 200 workers. We'd have a night crew and a day crew, you know. And so, and I was kind of, I had a good spot. My boss trusted me too. And so we had a really good operation. It was a time of plenty, and I could always find a job. No, I was in demand, and we did research on how to best remove crab from the shell and things like that. In fact, they paid for me a paid trip to Astoria to show them how to do the
remove the crab.
Remove crab, yeah, from.
Wow.
And.
Now, so that stayed up until pretty much the time of the earthquake. It was crab and salmon.
Yes,
is that what it was?
And until the earthquake, and it was still pretty, pretty good. Until then we start somewhere. Oh, I should say 10 or 15 years ago, we start getting these real high technical boats and things like that, and they were, really the sonar and all this good stuff, and the bigger the better, and the more pots out and things like that. I mean, they just rape the land, rape the sea is what it does. They just go in there and they just haul everything in, and throw like they were doing with the pollock, throwing the flesh away and just keeping the eggs,
mm-hmm.
Things like that. And our country allows it. They allow it. They know that it's going on, but they allow it because somebody's greedier than somebody else, and so they look the other way. They want to be elected or something. It's greed, pure and simple, that causes those things.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think about somebody else, and they don't think of what they're doing to the our resources.
It's just a waste.
Well, I'm glad that Senator Murkowski is going to Korea and Japan. Korea. I think it's Korea and Japan. I'm pretty excited about going. I think that it's going to be a good thing,
Mm-hmm.
They feel like they're being put upon, but by golly, they're ruining it for everybody in this world, They just go in there and they haul everything out.
Is this the IFQs? Oh, the Japan, keeping Japan out?
Yeah, not keeping Japan out, but they're these long line gill nets.
Oh, yeah.
They have gill nets 150 miles long, and they use this monofilament gear, which has been banned in the United States for years. We have gill nets all over the place, but we're not allowed to use the monofilament. Monofilament, you can't see in the water. A fish will run right into it and get snagged.
Oh.
And so just imagine what they were snagging.
All kinds of stuff.
All kinds of stuff and all kinds of fish.
Mm-hmm.
And even before the fish is mature,
Now, were you living here when the earthquake?
No, we were in Uganda. We spent when the state of Alaska banned fish traps, When they banned fish traps, that was this, where every company had fish traps, sometimes five or six of them, where that they just have these great big traps out there and they just scoop up 45, 50, 100,000 fish a day sometimes. And then, when the state of Alaska banned fish traps, then gill netting came into its own again, because you could go out there and you could set a net, a net and pick fish off of it and catch fish. Before that, you couldn't, Well, see, because before they had fish traps, they had gill nets, But finally, the fish traps just won over and wiped out a lot of the fishing, wiped out a lot of codfish. Now there's no fish traps, you can catch lots of codfish around here. And when the state of Alaska banned fish traps, Kelly decided that we would go see. I was not well, I couldn't stay in the crowd because I have asthma. And it was starting to kick up on me then. And the doctor had told me I better get out of the business or else I would be having a bad time. So he said we'll go out gill netting. And so we went out this one summer. It was wonderful. And we got a chance to be stay at one of the plants, winter watchman at one of the plants, organic plants. So we moved out there. We were out in Uganic. We built our own home in Mush Bay, and we lived out there for over 10 years, from 1959 until 1970 almost. We lost our two boys. We lost Freddie, was killed over in the Vietnamese War. He was a pilot. And Peter died soon after, I think probably with a broken heart. His brother was dead, you know. He's a little bit older than Freddie. And it just got to be too much to stay out there. Too many memories.
When you came back.
Yeah. Yeah. Then we moved back in here and we bought this place. Well, my mother lived next door. And I wanted to spend some time with her. She was 79. It was kind of ironic, though, that, you know, we moved in here several days after Mama passed away. We were moving in here, and she passed away before we moved in.
So she was here during the earthquake then?
Oh, yes. During the earthquake, our house was, you know where the Elks Club is?
Mm-hmm.
It's our house. That over the hill, there was a line of houses, and Mama lived next to the last house before the breakwater. And after the tidal wave was they started looking for Granny, you know. So Dick left his family, figured they'd be all right, and ran over to look for Mama and take her to a safe place. So he was taking her to a safe place, and Peggy and her mother and the babies moved on up someplace else, you know. And then he had to go look all night long looking for his family. They had them all up in the schoolhouse up here.
And who was this? This is
Dick and Peggy, you know. When Dick was married, his wife. They got Granny up to us, but Granny's place was just all, everything was all inundated. And the house, Dick's and Peggy's house, the water came up about this high, you know.
God.
Something. And we were in Uganic. We didn't, it wasn't as devastating over there. Well, the tide came in real high and the earthquake was really bad. It was really scary. We had Natalie and Diana, and we were sitting down at the table. I had something special for dinner. We had some pork that I made chop suey out of, which was a family favorite. And I was looking out of the window, sitting at the dining room, just eating, making dinner conversation. I said, Dick said that Vinayamanath, that one of the volcanoes blew up. You know, I said, gee, it's strange. We haven't heard anything more, or I guess maybe it's been pretty quiet. And all of a sudden, this started to shake.
Was it a bad shaking?
Oh, it was terrible. It was really terrible. There's a terrible, frightening thing about having a good old terra firma shaking underneath you, you know. But I guess it was much worse here in town. They said mm-hmm. that you could just see the road just ripple, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Ellen said she was. See, Ellen lived in there's these houses up that go up past the Baptist Church, you know, on this Upper Mill Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she said I was trying to run down to Germaine's. Germaine lived in the house below her, and she said, and she said I was falling down. She said I couldn't stand up.
So it was that.
Oh yeah, it was bad. It was bad. And then of course, after that, the tidal wave. You know, they didn't happen together. There was an earthquake, and it generated the tidal wave. Maybe an hour or so, I guess. And so it was pretty scary for people. And we were out in Uganic, and we didn't realize, you know, what was happening here until we started to, we used to always listen to Lola Harvey on the shortwave band, you know. And here's Lola. She said, you ought to see this place. She said, the big motor scow Salif is up in the schoolyard, and Kodiak doesn't look like Kodiak. You know.
Did you come over and see it?
Yes, we did. We did. We somebody from town, Paul Bayou and his crew came over to Uganic, and so we came in with him. We came in and spent some time with our kids. It was really scary. Yeah. Well, it was so, everything, this area was all right, but everything downtown was just all nasty and muddy. And of course, we lost some friends in it, you know. Kelly's brother, his mother was living down along the highway, and he didn't know what to do with her, so he took her aboard the boat with him. He had the Lex, you know, one of these power scums, and they rode that thing out.
Were they quite a ways out in the
channel? No, they were right in the, right? In the, what do you call it? And he just, he rode it out, you know.
It didn't get put ashore?
Well, you know, some of them lost their lives is they hit the breakwaters, you know, and things. But he rode it out. He said to his mother said to him, she said, the doctor said, but I have a bad heart, it's full of blue.
I made it through this.
Yeah. Really? Can you imagine?
And then they started just building up again.
Yeah. And then, of course, they did it better, you know. And Kelly worked on the docks when they were building up the boat harbor again. You know.
So. You see a lot of changes in Kodiak, I'm sure.
Yeah, but now, you know, now it's just entirely different. It's not at all like it used to be.
A lot more transient.
Yeah, well, that's it. And you know, you didn't lock your doors. You know, people didn't lock their doors, things like that. Now you're a little bit wary. Well, we had somebody walk in our house one night while we were sleeping. And we had two or three ivory tusks. And we had these usuks, you know, somebody that must have known where these things were came in here, and I don't know, something woke me up, and I must have coughed or something because I heard this twop, you know, and I came out here and both of these doors were wide open, and there was a flashlight. Well, Kelly found the flashlight, but our ivory tusk and the one of the usuks was gone.
Was gone?
Yeah. Oh. When he came out, he looked and here was this flashlight. The flashlight must have fallen and dropped and woke me up, you know. And so, you know, it kind of makes me nervous, you know. I lock this place up, we lock up. Kelly said it's just like the United States Ninja.
You have to lock up really good now.
You got you.
So it was really unique, I imagine, living back there. Did you ever travel like out to a fog neck in the other villages?
Oh, sure we did. We used to. Everything was by boat, you know. We didn't go by air. We started traveling by plane quite a lot in the 1950s. And then it was, gosh, you just hop in the plane and go, you know, because it was cheap. Gasoline was cheap. And then all of a sudden, in the 1970s or so, they start petering off because it was so expensive. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden here was gasoline, almost $2 a gallon, you know.
Right.
So not too many planes. But before then, gosh, everybody and his uncle ran around, you know, planes. Just
flying around.
Yeah.
Well, now, Woody was the biggest
village when you were growing up. That was when we were small. But then, see, Old Harbor, Eagle Harbor was one of the transient places. They would go there in the summertime. There was a church there. And then there was Kaguyak, Akyak. Those were just small settlements.
Mm-hmm.
After the tidal wave, they just kind of centered around. Old Harbor was always fairly large. But people from Woody Island built up Old Harbor. They went moved from Woody Island to Old Harbor because of the closeness of the fishing, you know, things like that. They could get, you know, they have salmon streams right close by. And then Akiak, of course, they lived in Kuguyak, you know. But Kuguyak was almost entirely destroyed by the tidal wave, so they moved to Akiak.
And you stayed there. But as far as the villages around here, the biggest was Woody.
No, these were when I was a child. The
right,
biggest,
when you were a child.
The biggest ones were a Fog Neck, Yuzinki, Karluk, Larson Bay. Those were always the biggest. But
always.
As far as I remember, you know, before then, Woody Island had more people than the two places here, you know. This was just a Russian settlement. That was mostly people.
Between there and Kodiak,
yeah,
it was bigger.
Between there and Kodiak. But then gradually these other places built up. Karluk was always a built-up place because it always had the potential for the fishing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Yuzinki was a good village spot, you know. And, of course, a Fog Neck was another place that people settled in.
The village there, except that was destroyed, I believe.
Yeah, by the tidal wave, too. Did you read Lola Harvey's Derevna's Daughters? Oh, that's a wonderful book. You should read it.
And what is the name of it?
Derevna's Daughters.
Derevna's Daughters.
She wrote it last winter. She wrote it based on the life of Eunice Nesset. And it's about this one family. This father came from Sweden and settled in a Fog Neck and married this Eulalie Grigoria. And they're related to half of a Fog Neck, and then proceed to have all these children. They're the Von Scheele family.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's a story of their life, and it's a nice, heartwarming thing. It really is. I had a copy, and I think I let Tina have it, and I don't have it again. I'm going to ask her if I can read it again, because it's worthwhile reading. And he kept copies of all the letters and things. And so he had all these things, and through these letters and stuff, Lola Harvey was able to piece together some pretty lucid incidents, I think.
Of what happened.
Yes.
So did everybody travel back and forth
from
a Fog Neck? Everybody was pretty much...
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, see, if you wanted to go any place, if you were going to go to Yuzinki, for instance, to work at the cannery in the summertime, you just get on the cannery boat, you know, and they'd take you over there. There was no such thing as you can't go because of insurance policies.
Right.
Nobody ever even thought about that, you know. Nobody thought of suing anybody or anything, and so they just have a load of people. When they went to town, they took a load of people in, you know.
What about language? What was the language? Did everybody...
Well, it was all
mixed.
Mostly Russian and Aleut, you know,
and
English, you know. The teachers in those, they spoke English. The rest of them spoke Russian, and the natives, the down-to-earth natives spoke Aleut, and everybody understood one another, even the storekeepers. Ben Kraft could speak the best Aleut you ever heard.
Really?
You betcha. Sure.
So everybody just understood, but...
Well, sure,
they
sure.
All
they just learned it, you know, proximity.
Gosh, seems like it would have been such a nice, quiet,
it was
different way of living.
It was fun times. There were fun times, too. Gosh, we used to have some fun. Masquerading times, they were so much fun. And our holidays were mostly around our church holidays, you know. They were religious, you know, because the Russian Christmas. And we observed the Lenten days and things like that, you know, because Papa was a starostar, that's a kind of a lay brother in the church, you know, and kept it clean and kept it nice and kept the pictures and everything polished up and so. we were always made to behave like the exemplary children.
What was weather like back then? Is there a big change in the weather?
It was colder. It seems to me it was much colder, and we had lots more snow than we do now. Because I remember digging, we'd have big drifts that were right alongside the house. And we skated all winter long. No, we rarely ever skate, you know, very long. The ice could stay on the lake.
Right. But before, when you were growing up, skating was a big
thing. Oh, all the time. I'd come home and I'd grab my skates and I'd be gone. Come home from school. Till supper time, and supper time you come home and eat supper, wash the dishes, and back out to the lake again.
Did you use, like, snowshoes a lot getting around? Or
No, we didn't need them. You know, there were roads and things like that, because we weren't, everything was close, you know, they were, you weren't spread out, you know, over on the island, the settlement was on the West Woody, you know, and, they were about as far as from maybe here to, the church, or maybe out to, the last house was way out to Kuzma's house, but you didn't have occasion to go out there very often. You know.
When you were growing up, was most of the families there basically natives, or were there as much Russian as natives?
No, they were all native. Native is mixed Russian and native, right. You know. And so the non-native people were the minority here. There were about four or five families. The rest were all Orthodox native. And all native. You know, to see it's a kind of a turnaround.
Mm-hmm. Now it's gone just the other way.
And now the natives aren't even a minority anymore. The Hispanos are the minority. You know. But, not that it matters. You know, it didn't hamper Kelly and I. We've made a good life for ourselves to make any difference.
Seems like that would have been a really nice way of living back then.
It was wonderful. Kelly and I, when Kelly was working for the FBA, of course he was making good money then. And we had a cow, and the kids would milk the cow. Buster, until I knew how to milk, I knew how to milk. So if anybody had to be missing, one of us would have to trot up to the barn and milk the cow, but we milked the cow. And we had a nice little speedboat, so after work in the evening, Kelly'd say, let's run over to town, and we'd go over to town, and we'd gas around for a few hours and have fun and get back home so he could go to work. And it was just wonderful. The children were healthy. They were swimming every day, and we worked in our gardens and stuff like that. You know, we kept things up.
Did many people work in the Alaska Company when it was over there, the ice house? Or did that employ very
well?
Native
people? That employed natives, but that was long, long time ago. Those were in the early 1900s and the late 1800s. You know, I'm not sure but I have some copies of Gary Stevens's about Woody Island. I should get them out for you. He had some statistics.
We went into that when it was coming up. I just wondered if there was anything left of it as you were growing up.
No. Well, there were things left. There was in the lake. There was one of the things that has happened over there is that upper lake that they used to make the ice and things that they shipped out. That was all dammed up. That was a lake that was made. You know, they dammed it up to make that lake, and so during one of the big rains last winter, it all washed out. You know, it all washed out, and these flumes, the things that they used to ship the ice out, and those all wore down. And there was a couple of old warehouses on the beach there that were there when the AC company was, and I think that they eventually were torn down after the FAA took over.
Right. When the war was coming on, did you get to see, like, the submarines or the boats coming in?
Well, we saw, thing I ever saw was we see the big ships come in, but the PT boats, those were exciting to come through, you know, those, we had read about them, and you know, PT 109 or yeah. something. Those were interesting. Those are really interesting. Water too. I remember. Well, we got running water at home when I was about 12, I think, 11 or 12. But I remember just turning on the tap, and Dad had to dig in a long way to get the pipe, you know, to set so we'd have running water. But we used to carry water from a well way behind. It was quite a distance away. Wash clothes with it.
In a little tub.
Washed up. Wash it by hand, you know, on a rubber scrubber. Did you ever see one of those things?
With the scrub boards?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen one in antique shops.
I have one out there. In fact, one that I used.
What about when it was time to become a state? What was the feeling like in the village and stuff? Where were you living at that time?
Here in Kodiak.
What was the feeling here? Everybody pretty much wanted it?
Yeah, I think so. Some people didn't want it. But I always thought that I've always been for progress. But then again, too, now, I mean, there's some things that I don't agree with. But at the time, I was considerably younger, and I thought that we'd have advantages that we couldn't get. But then again, too, with that, with advantages comes responsibilities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were a territory before. I think we've come out all right, except that I think that our legislators could change some of their tactics and do a little bit better.
Was there a lot of campaigning going on at that time, trying to get people to vote for it?
No,
or was
not
it just
really, not really. You see, everything here is on the subdued nature. I was one time when Mary Jo Simmons and somebody else were going around pounding on the doors, asking everybody, reminding everybody to vote for Jerome Selby. I was a little bit shocked, you know, because that's hardball stuff. You know, we don't do things like that here. We don't. People make up their minds, and you don't pressure people to make up their minds.
So there really wasn't any campaigning like going on about
never.
Wanting to vote for a state.
No, you might get one person that would say, oh, you know, if you do this is... But nobody was going around, publicizing anything, you know.
Everybody just pretty much went along that they wanted.
With what they wanted, yeah, that's right. And most everybody that voted for statehood. When did this happen? In 1958, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's about the same time they voted out. In fact, I think it was in the same session. They voted out fish traps, too,
right.
Because I think that we were more engrossed and
interested
in the fish trap thing, because because that meant a whole way of life for us, you know, that the statehood remained to be seen, but we knew that if we voted out fish traps that we would be able to have the ease of fishing, and the canneries wouldn't be just making up scot-free, you know. They still make up, of course, they pay this fish tax, but they still get off pretty well.
So that was the big thing back then. Instead of being a state, it was mainly everyone was interested in the fish traps.
Yeah, well, because this was purely and simply a fishing village, you know. And I mean, if all this other stuff goes through, people aren't going to be able to. The kids aren't even going to be able to fish, you know, from fishing families. It sounds to me
like IFQs.
I hope they come around with their paper. I got the first one. I was so cross. I threw it away, you know. And I'm sorry I didn't sign it, no, because I really think that they know what they're doing. I think that HICO is just playing with
everything.
Well,
it's hard, I think, because if you're a fishing person, I feel, coming from a lot of fishing people around here, that if we fish, if you haven't fished, if some reason happens and you haven't fished say halibut for the last 5 years,
then you're out.
You're out, yeah. You know, or your kids coming up that haven't fished. If you haven't, they don't even have a chance to.
Well, look at Dick. He didn't fish in 1972, and so he couldn't get a limited entry permit. Just that 1 year, you mm-hmm. know, that makes the difference. Ronnie, the same way.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's sickening about those things. And people that understand the thing, you know, like this Clem Killian that's behind a lot of this IFQ stuff. Clem Killian's whole family is all signed up for limited entry permits, you know, because he helped put the thing together.
Yeah, you know? I think that was the big...